What's that in your hair? I found some hair dye in the bathroom. You dyed your hair? Yeah. Just kind of a weirdo. This is Movies I Love That No One Talks About. I'm your host, Dan Benamor. Today, we're talking about the 2017 film, Good Time. The film stars Robert Pattinson, Benny Safdie, Jennifer Jason Leigh, and Barkhad Abdi. The Safdie brothers directed the film. Josh Safdie wrote the script with Ronald Bronstein. The film holds a 92% on Rotten Tomatoes. Depending on who you ask, it grossed $4.1 million on a budget of $2 million or $5.3 million on a budget of $4.5 million. Either way, was not a huge hit, especially compared to Uncut Gems, which grossed $50 million and now obviously looms over this movie. Quickly, before we get started, just know we are going to spoil the film. This is your spoiler alert. If you want to choose an upcoming episode of the show, click on Support This Podcast in the show description and support the show, and we can figure out a movie of your choosing that we both love. My guest today is Mark Marino. Mark is the writer, creator, and executive producer of Free Ray Sean, a Quibi series which starred Stephen James, Lawrence Fishburne, and Jasmine Cephas Jones. Free Ray Sean was executive produced by Antoine Fuqua and directed by Seth Mann, and both Fishburne and Cephas Jones won acting Emmys for their roles. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks, Dan.
So in honor of the Safdies, I've had an extremely frantic evening leading up to this podcast. So I'm in the mood to talk about this. And I want to first talk about the Safdie brothers' Theater of Anxiety, which has gotten them critical acclaim and which, you know, guys like us really like. But it doesn't work for everybody. My dad and my father-in-law, who are very different people, both hated Uncut Gems pretty much equally. I've talked to a lot of people who did like it. And this movie uses a lot of the same frenetic style of that movie. So I want to just open by us talking about why we like this and don't just find it annoying.
Absolutely. I don't find it annoying at all. I don't know that I would use the word that I like it. I think the way you described it, I don't know if you call it a cinema of anxiety or theater of anxiety. I watched Uncut Gems and had a really anxious feeling. You know, there were times when I think it brought up things from me kind of internally, right, about my own life, and times when I just, you know, wanted to take various characters on screen, grab them both by their heads and crack them together. I couldn't imagine it, but it happened that I felt even more that way during Good Time. It takes an incredible skill, which the Safdie brothers do phenomenally well, to create that sense of anxiety and then to keep us hooked in. So, I mean, I think guys like you and me do get hooked in. Apparently it doesn't work for your father. I can imagine a lot of folks for whom it also doesn't work, but I dig it. And I think that, you know, part of what I'm appreciating is, you know, the artistry and the nerviness and the grittiness that they pour into everything that they do.
Yeah. So this opens with this developmentally disabled guy who's played by Benny Safdie, and he's talking to this therapist and he breaks down crying. And then Robert Pattinson like basically breaks through the door and he kind of like breaks into my heart as an actor. Cause in the 2 seconds of him screaming at the therapist for making his brother cry, he was 1,000% more accessible to me as an actor than he'd been in anything I'd seen him in before. And, you know, I think obviously Pattinson, as we all know, sort of in a way got kind of a tough break, as much as it was a big thing for his career, because he became known for playing this vampire on Twilight, playing this detached, ethereal, just kind of floaty, dreamy kind of guy. I hadn't seen him play a real person. And this is a real person. And, you know, for me, it's my favorite Pattinson performance, but I haven't seen a lot of his like other weird indies, which he's in a lot of, like Cosmopolis, High Life, The Rover, The Lighthouse. Have you seen those?
I haven't. So my experience was I knew who Pattinson was by reputation. You know, it feels to me like if you said Robert Pattinson, I don't even know if this still exists, but I'm envisioning the cover of like Tiger Beat or something like that. You know, something you might see at the checkout line at a supermarket. I knew he was in the Twilight films. I could tell you that. I never saw those. You know, my children were never into the Twilight series, either as books or movies. I do know that he was in them with Kristen Stewart, who's another actor who's gone on to have an extraordinary, really compelling, really off the beaten path career. And so the thing that I did know about Pattinson was like, God, he worked with Cronenberg and he's worked with, you know, some of these other directors. I guess it was Michaud, right, for The Rover.
Robert Eggers. And,
what is it?
Robert Eggers for The Lighthouse.
Sure, right? I mean, with Defoe. And yet I haven't caught those performances. So when he burst into that room, you know, All I knew was, hey, here comes, you know, a teen star doing gritty, but parentheses, he's actually made a career of these really interesting performances. And I did actually read an article. I think it might've been Esquire, GQ, something like that. Recently, I was during lockdown where the writer was talking to him and really kind of getting embedded into his life for a couple of days. And it was like, oh, this guy's not putting on an act. You know, he's really interesting. You know, so I certainly was open to, let's see what this guy brings. And what he brings is so, I almost want to say ego-free. Yeah. You know, I think we've seen other big actors do small films. Yeah. And they, I can't think of any, I probably wouldn't want to call anyone out anyway, but where it's kind of like you can't, they can't sort of outstrip their own, you know, hugeness, you know. And actually a good example might be something that we talked about referencing this film early on, you know, Brad Pitt in Snatch, right? Mm-hmm. Because he's Brad Pitt. He's, you know, one of the top five actors on earth. So anytime he does anything, it's going to be just a little bit low budget or off the beaten path, or, you know, that was probably what, Guy Ritchie's second or third film. You know, you can't get over that's Brad Pitt. I was bringing less baggage to Pattinson, but he thoroughly disappeared in the role, you know? And it's interesting then when you do look at the other folks in this movie, yeah, Jennifer Jason Leigh, who's, you know, phenomenal, legendary actor who's been in a ton of things. And obviously Barkhad Abdi, who, you know, rose to fame with one large role and has made largely, obviously as the head pirate in Captain Phillips, but has otherwise largely had sort of character type roles. Mm-hmm. And then essentially, you know, folks that are non-actors, you know, I mean, Betty Safdie is almost a non-actor, right? I mean, he's a director. And the guy who played the therapist, I mean, I looked these people up on their IMDBs, and it was like the first or, you know, maybe second role, if at all, for most of them.
Yeah, I have this a little bit later, but we might as well go here now. So this is a huge thing with the Safdies, is this idea of casting non-actors. And you see it again and again in their films. In Uncut Gems, the guy who's the heavy, who has a huge part in that movie, he's just some guy. He's just like some guy from like New Jersey.
Right.
That's it. He's, hey, you want to be in a movie? And he was great. And if anything, he's even more believable because he's some guy from New Jersey. You actually believe that guy has done stuff like that before.
Right.
You see it in this movie. So just to kind of quickly move the audience through the plot, basically Robert pulls Benny out of talking to this therapist, tells him, hey, it's just you and me. I love you. We're going to go rob this bank. They go to rob the bank. They're wearing these masks that I don't know where the hell they would get these masks. There's like Stan Winston made these masks. They're like relatively lifelike. It makes them look like they're a different ethnicity. They actually make it through the bank robbery all the way to the getaway car. But then the dye pack explodes. The car crashes. They end up hiding the money in a Domino's bathroom. The cops chase them. Benny ends up getting caught, gets arrested. Pattinson runs off. Benny's in jail. Pattinson now has to get money to like bail him out. He goes back, gets the money from the hiding spot, goes to a bail bondsman, a guy with a yarmulke, which is great. And the bail bondsman says, you need 10 more grand to get him out of jail. And so it's, you know, I think that the guy who is the bail bondsman, again, I think I read some article or something that's just some guy that wanted to be in a movie, you know. And it's there in the prison too. If you notice, the inmates in the prison do not look like movie prison inmates. Like they look like actual guys. Like they just went into a prison and started filming.
Right. Because you're on it, and I know you're in the midst of the plot, but I'll just point out that there's a credit for street casting.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and it's Eleanor Hendricks, who I don't know who she is, but I know that she was in some of their early films. I think she was actually an actor herself in Daddy Long Legs, which was the Safdie's first film, or she may be a director in her own right. And I don't want to mess up her career here, but I know that she's worked with them on other projects. And, you know, the street casting, I don't know exactly what that credit means, but like, you could go to LA and there's casting companies that specialize in sending you dudes that look like the extras from Training Day or Colors or whatever.
I was one of those dudes, by the way. When I first got to LA, I was an extra, and you would basically call in and they'd tell you what the things were. And I got to play an inmate in an episode of House. So it was basically me and a bunch of guys with tattoos. And, you know, there is a certain look that the casting directors just picked that look. And this was not that. This was just a bunch of regular looking guys and sort of like weird looking guys. That's a big thing about their casting, is that people, they look like real people, which we're just not used to. Like our brains have to be retrained to like process reality.
Right. Right. I think that, you know, maybe we'll stick a pin in this while you continue plowing through the plot, but the casting, in addition to the location shooting, in addition to the available light, in addition to the handheld, there's this authenticity
totally.
That is extraordinary. And it pops when you've got, you know, I don't frankly know Benny Safdie's character's name, but when you've got the Benny Safdie character in the holding cell, and, you know, maybe they're already on Rikers, but nevertheless, he was in a fairly crowded cell. All those other guys, you know, I mean, those really, I know I'm making a big assumption here, but from what I know about the way the Safdies work and what I know from, you know, the street casting credit, like, I don't think all those dudes have IMDb pages and headshots and agents, you know.
These are just guys who basically were like, here's $50. Can you let us film you for a day? And they just found these guys on the street. That's a big part of the thing. I also want to just call out very briefly, just because I'm a Jew and it's for me. In Uncut Gems and in this movie, they just sneak in some like low-key Jewish stuff, just kind of in the margins. And I think that part of the reason I like these guys so much, and it's more pronounced in Uncut Gems, but I'm an anxious Jew who loves gambling and movies, and they are anxious Jews who love gambling and movies.
Oh, clearly. I mean, I know we're not doing Uncut Gems here, but I mean, I was reading about the process of how they had to find the perfect like three-game series, you know, because obviously Uncut Gems is a very unique of the moment period piece during, you know, whatever, I guess it was a Celtics Knicks
something like that,
matchup, whatever. You know, very, I guess that speaks both to the authenticity, you know, I'm not Jewish, but I'm Italian from Jersey, which is actually very close. The way in which they bring that in this film with the bail bondsman, who's phenomenal. You know, and then of course also Uncut Gems with Eric Bogosian and Sandler and the rest is fantastic. Yeah. Okay. So you got to get back to the plot.
Yeah. So basically Pattinson needs this money, ends up going to see Jennifer Jason Leigh. They never really explain their relationship, but it's sort of implied that he's like a boy toy. She's older. She keeps talking about, hey, aren't we going to go on vacation? She holds his hand in the car. He tells her it's only a couple of grand. And then when they get to the bail bondsman, it's 10 grand. And he says, what's the difference? And she says, 7 grand. I just want to talk for a second about the authenticity of the hustler character personality they put in this, because I know people like this, quite frankly, at earlier points in my life, I've probably been close to being a person like this. Like it feels so real in these little touches.
Absolutely so real. He's got an answer for everything. Cause I mean, she says 7 grand, and then he says, you know, he's pretending as if it's just bail money that she's going to get back. So he says, you know, you'll get it back anyway. What's the difference if you're getting 3 grand back or you're getting 7 grand back? Cause you're going to get it back anyway. He's, I don't think it's incorrect to say, I mean, he's absolutely awful. You know, I mean, I think we can talk later about having compassion for a character like this or finding something lovable, maybe, but like ultimately, or rather I should say prima facie, he's manipulative, he's lying, he's hustling, he's self-centered, he's violent, he's, you know, it's, and what he's doing with her, particularly in that scene, right, is really, it's really terrible. And of course, what happens is, you know, her mother, who had seen him coming a mile away, you know, the doorman wasn't supposed to let him in anyway. Yeah. She's already turned the card off.
The mom is like the secret hero of this movie. The mom was right.
Yes.
So it turns out that Benny has been hospitalized after he got in a fight in jail. He does not have a court date yet. So Pattinson goes to find him in the hospital. He waits for the guard to take a coffee break, sneaks his brother out in a wheelchair. Then we get the most tense getting disabled people onto a bus scene in cinematic history. And Pattinson meets some lady on this bus and convinces her to give his brother a room for the night. He's just met her, known him for like 5 minutes. And then he proceeds to be worst house guest of all time. He uses the phone, dyes his hair, goes through the fridge looking for food, makes out with her 16-year-old granddaughter.
Yeah, there's not much worse he could have done, and I think that part of as we're talking through this, it's sort of like, you know, we're leaving out actual chunks of sequences where he doesn't actually get off the bus with them.
Right.
He's actually, you know, the driver's like, wait a minute, why do I still have you on this bus? I was only supposed to have three people. And then, just take me down the block. And then he walks and doubles back to that woman's house and talks his way into her house. You know, one of the things that I like is that it's never, she's not like, oh, you poor guy, and like super sympathetic. She sort of lets him stay because why not? And you know, she's got her granddaughter with whom she has a fight and who she yells at and like gets in her face. I mean, nobody is warm and cuddly in this movie, you know. Nobody is you know, just like, oh, this poor woman, and I feel for her, or anything like that.
I think that this movie represents a neurotic view on life. Like, for people who are anxious, I mean, I'm certainly an anxious person. I think that this is sort of why I like The Sopranos. This is why I like a lot of other things like that. In The Sopranos, for example, there's always a problem. There's always something wrong. Everything's difficult. Everybody is pissed off. It's not this sort of sanitized version of life that we see mostly in movies and TV and stuff like that. And I think that's why I find their movies so relatable, because I'm just like, oh, this is just real life. Real life is a pain in the ass. There's always problems. Nothing is easy, you know. And I think that's part of sort of the messy charm of what they do.
Yeah, that's a great way to think of it. And I think taking, you know, one step back, speaking really frankly, collectively for this and Uncut Gems, you know, the main characters also bring so much on themselves.
Totally.
Make such a consistently near flawless, devastating sequence of terrible choices, one right after the other. And so did Tony Soprano, right? And so did everybody in his crew. You know, and then there's that other piece that's sort of like completely unsatisfied, that constantly pissed off, the constantly aggressive attitude, kind of, you know, attacking all of their mostly self-induced problems with the worst attitude possible. And, you know, times when my life isn't going well, which, you know, I think 2020 has been a big disaster for everyone. I know certainly for me, you know, both, you know, globally, culturally, personally, you know, sometimes it bears a little bit of looking back, stepping back also and being like, how much of this current, you know, heartbreaking mess that you're enduring is your own actions, your own mistakes, and the attitude with which you, you know, continue to plow through these things.
I think the Safdie brothers are one of the few filmmakers where I watch their movies and I worry about them personally. Like, concerned about them. All right, we're going to take a quick break for our sponsors. I'm going to leave you with this before we come back. Pattinson broke out the wrong guy. We'll be right back. Okay, we are back. So yeah, this whole time, this guy that he broke out, his face was covered in like bandages and stuff. And only when he wakes up do we learn that Robert Pattinson did not free Benny. He freed just like some totally random prisoner, who obviously is very confused what he's doing there. And I thought this was a good place to talk about the quality of their writing, because that's actually a great twist. And you talked about it before, this documentary style that they do. You get the feeling when you watch it, it feels like the Safdies are just flying by the seat of their pants, and it's just like, hey, it's Tuesday. What are we going to do today? Like, that's not it. Gems, I mean, I've listened to them talk about the writing process for Gems, and at different points, I think they had Jonah Hill and Harvey Keitel and Joel Embiid and I think Kobe at one point. And each time they would rewrite the script to make it fit those different actors. And they did, by the time it was all said and done, and Sandler and everything, like 100 drafts of that script. So, you know, I want to just talk for a second about, are they underrated as writers because of the style, which makes you feel like they're just making it up as they go along?
Right. That's a great question. I don't, you know, based on what you just said and talking about their script writing process, anyone who makes work that is incredibly authentic and gritty and often handheld, or, you know, we might use the term cinema verite or a documentary like realness or whatever we want to do, is going to get under credited as a writer, because the popular imagination of the film going or, you know, cinema watching or TV watching public thinks, you know, if it looks like it's off the cuff and improvised and it sounds like it's off the cuff and improvised, well, then it must be improvised. And take nothing away from actors who are phenomenal, you know, improvisers, you know, when your writing comes off like that, it's unfair to the writers. And in fact, this twist that you're talking about is a particularly awesome way to look at them as writers, right? Like, that's a very intelligent writerly twist. I don't remember exactly when it happens, but I'm guessing it's probably right about the midpoint, which is, yep. You know, I'm obviously, you know, a professional writer. You know, we know the importance of, if you've got, I think the runtime is about 100 minutes, and I bet you it's at 45 to 50 minutes in, yep. that dude sits up in the extra bedroom, and I'll tell you, it shocked the hell out of me. I mean, there was just no reason not to think that he had gotten his brother out. And I don't know, you know, if you'd stop me right before that and said, okay, what do you expect is going to happen next? My guess would have been there will be continued complications based on his brother being, you know, developmentally disabled and now, you know, beaten to a pulp. And they're going to continue to try. He's actually broken out now, so he's a fugitive, which is really the least, you know, sensible way to try to get somebody out, right? And you know, I probably would have thought that it would have taken on a sort of almost picaresque quality as they tried to get out and maybe get down to Virginia or wherever he had originally said their goal was to get, you know. And I could have seen it going the route of maybe, and this isn't their style and clearly it didn't go this way, but almost maybe a little bit of a more heartfelt sort of, you know, the indie drama, which, you know, I love, that you might see at Sundance where, you know, they finally get on that bus and like the final shot is like the bus pulling out of Port Authority and they're together and we know it's going to be hard and we don't know what they're going to make of themselves, but they're kind of, they're heading off to, you know, wherever they're heading off to. And that is the furthest fucking thing from what happens, because this dude wakes up and he is, just as much of a hot mess as Pattinson. And then the two of them together, you know, just set it off for the remainder of the film.
It is a car crash of a story at that point. You're just like, you just like kind of like look through your fingers. You're like, what is going to happen here? And it's such a great, you know, you bring up a really great point, because you can figure out as writers, and I think this is the general audience, which is very savvy, when the audience can predict where it's going to be, right? And it's like, we know what's going to happen in this movie for the next hour. And it sort of happens like that. They just check out, right? And it's such an important lesson for us as writers to like, act two midpoint, do some crazy shit, because it re-excites the audience. It reignites their energy.
Absolutely. I mean, and it's, you know, if anybody was ever listening to either of us for writing advice, you cannot wait until page 50 to figure out what that is going to be. You know, you will sometimes have a happy, oh my God, wouldn't it be amazing if this happened? But that is not how these guys set off to make this movie, right? They knew before they sat down to write that halfway through, it's going to turn out that he broke out the wrong guy. And that's going to, because if that hadn't been the case, nothing that happens in the back half of this movie would ever happen. So it is a great example of the you know, sort of almighty importance of a really great midpoint for writers. But I would not advise to start writing and think you're going to find something, because, you know, when you've got something like that, it's going to affect everything that happens in the second half. It's not just a surprising moment that you get a surprise and then you get back onto the trail of your regular story. Yeah. So, you know, I heard somebody talking recently about how, something about how a lot of The Office was improvised, and it's like, you know, I wasn't on the set of The Office. I don't know. And I didn't sort of like raise the flag for writers everywhere to be like, look, all of those people were comic geniuses, all those actors. I'm sure there were a lot of great improvised lines and funny things, but you know, you don't do whatever they did 150 episodes of improv, you know. And even when you talk about, you know, sort of a famous dramatic director who's like Mike Lee, you know, Mike Lee's films are not improv. Mike Lee does extensive rehearsal where they build the characters together and then they write through, you know, what they've found, and then they have a script going forward. But if you look at something like this, what the Safdies did here, you know, it'd be tempting to think that it was all just seat of their pants, you know, and the truth is that's not it at all. They had, you know, literally like movie stars and a full crew and cameras. You know, this was not two guys with a high eight camera, you know, running through Queens all in one night. You know what I mean? Like this was a very, very artfully made film that, a huge part of the art or the artifice was making it look about as scuzzy as an episode of Cops, which they actually watch at one point, you know.
That's great.
Yeah.
So the random guy and Pattinson and the granddaughter, the 16-year-old granddaughter, steal the grandmother's car, run off. They can't go back to the hospital. There's cops all over the place. We find out the random guy's entire life story, everything he did after he got out of prison. It's like a 10-minute monologue with flashbacks, and it's just some random guy we just met. We find out everything about him, and then at the end he goes, "Yo, are you listening to me?" And somewhere in this rambling story, Pattinson gets the idea to go to Adventureland, because in the story, the random guy mentions there's drug money hidden there. And, you know, they probably could have gotten there a little bit easier, narratively speaking. Why do you think they decided to do this massively giant monologue flashback thing with this random guy?
It's interesting because it pulled me out of the story for a moment, because I feel like the kid says early on, I don't even remember what happened. You know, he says something about not having a great memory of what happened. And then he lays out this really extraordinarily detailed, and then because we're getting visual flashbacks of it all happening, he lays out this extraordinarily detailed story of exactly what happened. I think it gooses the story, right? It gives us a pause away from the sort of relentless, anxious, nihilistic, you know, bird-brained, you know, Pattinson adventure, and kind of, in a certain way, lets us know that we, the other side of this car crash, as you describe these two characters meeting, is just as big a, you know, sort of disaster. You know, I read some reviews kind of getting ready for this, and I typically like A.O. Scott in The Times, but he, it felt like a decent review, and then he kind of savaged it a little bit at the end. But he described this character as, like, you know, perhaps, and I wish we knew his name, but I think it almost speaks to the incredible sort of immediacy and grittiness and authenticity. Like, we don't know their names, you know. He's certainly not a name actor. We just sort of zoom along with these people all night. Like, the names kind of aren't important, so it's funny that we're sitting here talking about them. Anyway, A.O. Scott was sort of even less kind. He said, "My God, if there's, you know, anybody who was a bigger disastrous mess than Pattinson, it was this guy." But he also, I mean, both of them felt very familiar.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I am not unfamiliar with violent, self-destructive, nihilistic, living like moment to moment men. You know what I mean? Like, in my world, I know a lot of that. And these guys embody that really, really well.
They, so they go to Adventureland. They're looking for this money that, you know, is basically drug money that's there. They end up incapacitating a security guard. Robert poses as him by taking his uniform. The cops show up, take away Crystal, who's had the worst night ever since meeting Pattinson. That's the 16-year-old granddaughter. They take the security guard's car. They take his ID. They go to his apartment. Pattinson wants this random guy to call his drug dealer friend. And they found this bottle of LSD that he was selling at the park. And Pattinson wants to basically sell it back to the drug dealer. The random guy says, "Give me a minute to relax. It's been like a pretty rough night." Pattinson is like, "No fucking way. We're doing it right now." And I thought, is there any better microcosm for the Safdie's sensibilities when it comes to pacing than that moment right there?
There really isn't. That scene when the two of them are in the security guard, who is Barkhad Abdi, who you really softened it by saying they incapacitated him. I mean, you know, if we haven't already been clear that Pattinson's character's name is Connie, by the way, that Connie's a complete asshole. They beat the absolute shit out of this guy. They absolutely fucking pummel him, you know, in a way that is nearly, which is absolutely awful and nearly gratuitous. So clearly they take his keys and his you know, security guard van. They go back to his apartment and, you know, shout out to my friend David here, because David was like, you've got to watch Cool Time. You got to watch Cool Time. What the fuck is he talking about? And then finally, like, somehow, I told you, we talk East Coast, West Coast, or like, we talk mostly through voicemail sometimes. He got out that it was Brothers, who directed another movie with Adam Sandler. So I was like, Uncut Gems, you're talking about Good Time. Okay, I'll watch it. Boom, I watched it a week ago. And so he was talking to me about how polished the security guard's apartment was, right? Maybe not, it wasn't ostentatious. You're not going to see it on Cribs, but it was neat. It was nice. It had a nice couch, it had a nice TV, and he had some nice liquor on the shelf. And indeed, Ray, this second character, just wants to relax and drink some booze. You know, I mean, he's been against his, he didn't even know why he was handcuffed to a hospital bed, because he could, and that's what he said early on. I don't remember why he was handcuffed to a hospital bed, but then we see that ultimately at some point he had jumped out of a moving vehicle in the midst of a car chase involving, you know, drugs and drug dealing from, you know, Queens to Long Island. But it's really subtle, and I think probably worth at some point visiting some of the racial elements of the plot here. But, you know, the Barkhad Abdi character's apartment is really nice. You know why? Because he works. Because he works hard. Maybe that's his second job. Because he takes care of his things, because he shows up for work on time, and he has a responsible job, and he does a good job, right? Until these two, you know, sort of vicious miscreants, like, kind of, you know, overwhelmed him. And not for a moment, I think, do either of these characters stop and look around and say, I could have a life like this, you know? And it may be, and on the one hand, it may be well out of their, you know, their sort of capacity to ever achieve anything like that. And on the other hand, you know, a little bit, because we do know, you know, sort of the history of the actor Barkhad Abdi, but also the character's clearly playing a Somali immigrant, right? You know, I mean, that is clearly a character who came to this country and built this for himself. And that never occurs to these characters. One of them just wants to drink and get more fucked up, and the other of them wants to just keep on plowing forward with completely harebrained, insane schemes. That moment, that location, that scene is an extraordinary microcosm, you know, for the whole film and for both the actors. So it was important, you know, to kind of call out that apartment. You know, it's subtle, but like it never even occurs to them that like this is a world that they could have, and at the same time, it doesn't slow you know, Connie down for a moment. He is just, you know, no, gotta do it now, and so then we see what happens next.
Yeah, so that gets us to basically the final kind of string of events of the movie. The drug dealer shows up. Pattinson tries to get $15,000 for the bottle of acid. The guy says yes, but then indicates he's really going to just go get a gun. Pattinson leaves. The cops come and arrest him. The random guy falls to his death trying to sneak out the window. Benny winds up back in the special needs program from the beginning of the movie. That's it. Credits roll. Pattinson has been arrested. He's presumably in prison. I think it's an interesting comparison point to Gems, because in Gems, the diamond is the valuable object. In this one, it's a little bottle of acid. In Gems, Sandler gets shot in the face and dies. In this movie, Pattinson gets arrested. So it's almost like they took each ingredient and just kind of turned the volume up on it a little bit as they went into Gems from this movie.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it. You know, I think many filmmakers, and certainly myself, looking at, you know, my writing, things, you know, produced, unproduced, you know, things I've sold, things I've written for myself for short films, whatever, kind of come back to a lot of the same themes and sort of even sometimes the same ways, you know, even unfolding in a lot of the same ways. And I think that these guys are certainly doing that with these two films. you know, the end is interesting because, you know, we just see Pattinson's character, Connie, get arrested, but then we don't see him again. And indeed, you know, we see the Ray character, played by an actor named Buddy Duress. We see him trying to get out a window. And I mean, we know what this dude has been through. You know, he did not have the physical capacity to climb like from a window or whatever. And indeed falls, tragically falls to his death. But we don't end there on either of them. What we do is we end up with Benny's character, Nick, in whether it's a group home or a group class with other folks who are developmentally disabled and playing a game about like emotion and truth, you know, with a teacher. And it's a sentimental ending. It's a thoughtful and sort of kind and open-hearted ending, right? Because there's a degree to which Buddy is going to get better care from, you know, his therapist Peter is there again, where he's going to get better care from Peter and from the woman teaching the class and from being with other folks, you know, than he would if he was actually, you know, had successfully stolen $65,000 from a bank and joined his brother and gone with his brother to Virginia. With that said, I'm not sure. I felt like I had so much invested by that point with Connie that I almost wanted to see him, you know. I'm not saying what I would have done if I was a filmmaker. I'm just talking as the viewer. I found that ultimately, I think I was more invested in Connie and the journey we'd taken with him all night, and wanted more of a coda, maybe also an emotional coda, right? But wanted more of a tale to his experience. You know, I think, let me put it this way. Connie spends the entire movie from the very beginning to the end striving to get money, you know, any means necessary to be able to take care of his brother, Nick. He does it in ways that are increasingly violent and idiotic. And when it ultimately all fails and falls apart, I have at that point been invested in that and invested in kind of who he is, even when I think so many of the choices are so antithetical to actually properly caring for his brother. Let's say, you know, sort of seen very early on when he actually brings him on a bank robbery to give me a button of closure with the character. I think I would have preferred that button of closure with the character. And as I talk through it, you know, what would it have been? It would have been on him, Rikers, pissing somebody off, beating the shit out of somebody, or getting the shit beaten out of him, right?
Yeah, perfect. You know what
I mean? Yeah.
I think that's a great note to end on, him going to Rikers and beating the shit out of somebody. That is our show for this week. If you want to keep up with the show, join our Facebook group at Movies I Love That No One Talks About, or follow me on Instagram at the same. I want to thank my guest, Mark Marino. Until next time, bye-bye.